when I came in to recovery, I kind of came into recovery wanting to drink like a lady. I thought, you know, I'm actually not that bad. Or I don't even know, but I thought I want to go out and just be able to have a little glass of wine and be okay. And that wasn't the case, you know, because I never had just one glass of wine.
I'm Paul Scolfort, and this is Powerful. In this series, I come clean about my own sobriety and the journey it took for me to get here. In each episode, I will speak to a special guest about their addictions and how they achieve sobriety and how they maintain a happy lifestyle today. So today, I'm very excited to introduce a long-term friend of mine, Joe Langley, where we discuss idolising an alcoholic, how to maintain sobriety, and the first time she used ecstasy. So in some of these episodes, there will be discussions of alcohol misuse, drugs, sexual abuse, suicide, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. Joe Langley, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. Obviously, this is about sobriety, and you're a big girl in sobriety, so to speak, with lots of years of experience, a coach, nutritionist, and many other things.
Mm-hmm.
So would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you for having me. Lovely, Paul. I am in recovery, as you said. I am a mum and I'm a coach. And I kind of feel that everything I do, am doing, stems from my journey with recovery.
So we've known each other for a long time.
We have.
You think we met in the Priory, but I remember some early hours of the morning in East London once in someone's house, meeting you there. Do you remember that?
No, I don't really, although there were many evenings and that went into days like that, I don't actually remember many of them. I feel quite sad that I don't remember you.
I can inform you later. But yeah, and I remember because we'd come back from some club and someone knew your friend whose house it was, and we went to their house, and I got really intimidated because her boyfriend came back late at night, and I thought some weird situation was going on. I pretty much just left.
Wow, that was like a standard sort of...
Sort of stuff. But I just wanted to tell people that my charity, Stride Foundation UK, we're doing a new program for schools, and you're going to be one of the main speakers for us to go into schools about recovery, alcoholism and addiction, mm-hmm. and to help kids to have awareness about it. But where did it start for you? Where are you from, and how did you discover alcohol, and did you have any think that in your upbringing kind of helped you become addicted to alcohol or drugs?
It's funny, when you come into recovery, you learn... You sort of backtrack and you learn a lot. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I wasn't around alcohol a lot as a child because you hear different stories, you know, people's different experiences. I didn't experience that, but I now know with my journey in recovery that I had these feelings and emotions of never feeling comfortable where I was. So it sort of was in my head, and that need as a child to change the way I felt, you know, with anything, with people, or just never feeling comfortable internally, but on the outside, being really confident. So I wasn't like a little wallflower. I was quite rebellious at school, but not naughty, just wanted to be centre of attention. But that feeling you learn about in recovery of inside, it's like just filling that hole of whatever it was with a thing, a person, or changing the way you feel. And I did that with emotions from a kid. A funny story, I've told you this before, but it's not funny actually, but because I wasn't sort of surrounded by alcohol as a child, I mean, I was brought up by my mum. She was a single parent. I had two older brothers. And it wasn't terrible at all, but it was challenging, you know. And from quite a young age, I worked in a hairdresser's in North London, where I was brought up. And the guy who owned this salon was... it was like a shampoo and set salon. I used to work there two nights after school on a Saturday. And I was obsessed with this guy. He was... He used to have these ladies lining up, waiting for him. And he was like a genius, an artist. He was... The way he styled their hair with the back combing and the... Just the... He really was... It was... They were works of art. And... Between each client, he used to smoke, remember the Dunhill Red Dunhills?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So they were going in the ashtray constantly. Between each client, he was fully booked day in, day out. He used to go out the back, and behind the towel rails, there was Johnny Walker's Red Label. Sorry, this is not an ad, but whiskey
yeah.
that he used to drink. And when he wasn't styling hair... He would shake his whole body, like he was an alcoholic. And I was mesmerised by him. I just thought, like, we used to find, like, literally, not just the odd bottles behind where we used to keep the towels. And it was kind of like an unspoken thing that he was just drunk. So I used to look at him and think, well, he's drunk or an alcoholic and he's brilliant. And that was my first experience with alcohol, because I didn't see it at home.
It's funny, isn't it? Because for me, when I saw people drinking in the family, it put me off of drinking.
Yeah.
But I did have an uncle that used to drink whiskey and smoke cigars, and I thought, God, I want to be like him. He looks so cool. But he was never one of the people in my environment that was drunk or nasty. He's just a good man, but he loved a glass of whiskey.
Yeah.
And he used to just make it like an old American Western that was very attractive.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess that's what happened with
For
you.
For sure. And I think that people are under this sort of, I don't know, illusion, you know, fast forwarding it a little bit. I thought an alcoholic was someone who was in a doorway or, you know, in a really bad way. And it's... It's definitely not how people look, because I thought he was amazing. And for me, that's what kept me in the denial of my addiction for a really long time, because I was functioning. And even though he was drunk. I mean, when he stopped doing the hair, he was shaking. And as soon as he hit the stage, he'd just do these amazing... And I always thought that you had to... It wasn't an inside job. I thought it was outside. If you looked like an alcoholic or you looked ill, but I later, as I've done the work in recovery, know it's nothing about the outside.
So, what do you think an alcoholic is now?
When as I sort of went on with my career with hair, I excelled, and I was quite young. I was working in the West End at a really well-known salon, and I was quite scared of drinking and using drugs. I was quite a late starter, really. But my fear was almost like a form of control, because there was a little voice in me that was kind of saying, if you start, you're never going to stop. Because everything I did, once I did it, it was to excess. So there was maybe, I don't know whether it was wisdom, but something... held me back. And when I did start, it was very, very controlled. Typical addict sort of, this addict's
behaviour.
But
when you started, was you conscious of that and you're like, I'm just going to have a little bit where everyone's doing?
Yeah.
Or was it like some sort of intuition where you...
It was a mixture of all of those things. It was controlled, a little bit of intuition, that little voice thinking, once you start, you're not going to stop. And your question was, what do I think of how has my opinion or whatever changed of addiction now? And it is an inside job. it is not so much, you know, we'll get onto that, I'm sure. I've got teenagers that fully know about my past. Not everything, but they know. And their first question is, what drugs did you take? You know, and for me, it doesn't matter now. Because when I was using, I didn't ever think that I had a problem with alcohol. And I kind of, towards the end, knew that I had a problem with drugs. Like, I really knew I had a problem. Because once I started, I couldn't stop. And when I look back, the way that I felt, the things that I did, I would never do those things now and haven't for a really long time. But the drink was always the thing that I did first. Always the thing that I would pick up a drink first and then that would be it.
When did the control leave you? Because weirdly, I kind of have a similar experience. And some people say once they took their first drink, that was it. They was off to the races. They felt amazing. It changed the way they felt. And it was like they found, you know, a gold mine at the end of the rainbow. That wasn't my experience. But at one point, I'd crossed this invisible line. Do you remember or do you know when that was?
I really do. It was at a place, because when I, back in the day, it was the rave scene. And
good times, just saying.
Sorry, but the, you know, there were some really incredible times. I'm really fearful for my children. I've got young adult children. I'm very fearful because it sounds so cliche, like it's just such a mum and dad thing to say, like it's not like it was years ago. And they're listening to the music that we were listening to. It's like the old songs. But it was a place called the Downham Tavern, and I'll never forget it. I can't remember some of the things I did a month ago. And I remember walking in there, and it was a dump. It was an old massive pub, and it was like an all-dayer.
Where was this?
It was South London. And I remember walking in there, and I remember that feeling. I hadn't had a thing. I just used to have like the odd drink then. I hadn't taken drugs. And I remember the feeling of euphoria, literally filling my body and looking and just thinking, whatever they are taking, I want that now. And that was my first experience.
What were they taking?
With ecstasy.
Right.
Then. And
which it says what it does on the tin, basically.
And it was just, you know, they were crazy times, you know, the late 80s, the 90s, you know, the clubs. It was a movement, really, wasn't it? It was
amazing. It was a movement for sure. And for me, I suffered from a lot of anxiety as a kid. And I'd seen a lot of things go on in the pubs, and you remember the 70s were pretty rough.
Yeah.
Into the early 80s, there was a lot of football violence and
pub
violence. And somehow, probably like the 60s, when the rave scene come on, it was amazing because you'd get 1,000 people in a room or 5,000 people in a field sharing water, hugging each other.
Just love.
It was amazing. And for me, what a lot of people talk about who come into recovery is that they feel like they're either born with a layer missing of skin.
Mm.
So in other words, they're really sensitive and open to stuff, empathetic. And they kind of have to have this hard veneer or medicate the oversensory system with alcohol or drugs.
Yeah.
And then you start to numb yourself and you just carry on. And for me, I felt like that as a child. So when I started to go to the rave scene, I actually felt like I'd arrived somewhere.
Yeah.
And I was safe. And this was amazing because there's going to be no violence. Everyone loves each other. The music was incredible.
The music was amazing. You just took the words out of my mouth. The music was amazing.
It was a really good time.
It was. You felt like you belonged. There was a really strong sense of belonging. And everyone was doing it. It was incredible when I think back to those sort of early times, you know, Limelights, Legends, all of these places. They were just, I don't think there's clubs. I mean, I don't go out, but I don't think there's clubs. I can't imagine there's places like that that you literally, you would walk. I know the substances helped.
Yeah.
Legends, Limelights, you know, these places were just, it was like a, I was going to say the word cult, but it was like you couldn't miss.
You can leave from a club, but you can't leave from a cult, apparently.
Yeah, well, I actually, some of the clubs I didn't leave. I was like the first one in, last one out. But it was amazing. And when I think back to those times, I have no regrets at all. When I think back to those times, it was just the whole thing of it, the whole, you know, the whole experience of that. But
what happened after then? Because for me, when that kind of died off the rave scene, and to be quite honest, towards the end, a couple of people started to die from taking pills that were on the black market or weren't great. And that actually scared me because I thought, you don't, it's the first time I thought you don't know where this is coming from. Maybe I shouldn't take it. And then I kind of moved back on to drink again a bit more. Mm. And it kind of got a bit darker and not so much fun again. Yeah. And it was a bit, you know.
I had some really scary experiences. I had loads of scary experiences, actually. And, you know, at the time we thought was really funny. But now when I look back at it, as a mother of an 18-year-old, terrifies me. Because my mum had no idea what I was doing. I know that for sure. And that's why with my children, I say to them, don't kid a kidder. And they're really honest and open with me. You know, we used to leave our car. This is actually a true story of me and my friend. We'd left our car over in Stoke Newington, then gone back to a house for a party, completely off of our heads. Then 2 days later, still partying, decided to go back to get my car. We've got a cab. And we couldn't remember where we'd parked the car. And we're in the middle of like Stoke Newington, and I think it was Stoke Newington, really rough where we were, still off our heads.
At the time, because Stoke Newington's now is quite posh.
Stoke Newington's lovely. Where we were wasn't posh and it wasn't lovely. Sorry, no offence. I love Stoke Newington. I don't even know. We went back in the cab and we couldn't find or remember, the cab dropped us off, where we thought the car was. There's two girls, young women, off their nuts still, laughing. And we just used to put ourselves in situations like that, and we didn't find the car for hours. You know, really dangerous situations. I used to think, when I first came into recovery and I used to hear people talk about blackout, I used to think I never blacked out. Because I used to think when you blacked out, you literally had to, like, pass out. I used to end up at a party somewhere and kind of come to and think, how did I get here? Like over the other side of London and with sort of people that you didn't really know. And you always stuck together with some of your friends. That was one thing. You were never just left, go off. But just really scary, scary. Blackout.
So it's really interesting about blackout because that word is bandied around a lot.
Yeah.
Completely misunderstood.
Yeah.
I thought it was unconscious as well.
Yeah, like
and I thought,
passed out.
I've never had a blackout. I'm all right. I'm okay. But there was times, leaving somewhere and then arriving at home or somewhere else thinking, I don't even actually remember that.
Yeah.
And in recovery, I always looked back at what I'd done at certain points to try to remember.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of blackouts.
Yeah.
Like a lot of stuff.
And the morning drinking thing as well. I remember sort of when I came into recovery, listening to people talk about, and straight away, I never did that. I was out for like 2 or 3 days. I was still drinking the next morning, you know, and it's, you just carried on. I mean, you didn't, once you started, you knew you weren't going home. I mean, sometimes I used to go to work. I was a hairdresser then. I always felt really creative when I was off my head. I mean, my poor clients now, if ever they knew that, but no one ever suffered at the peril of my still buzzing hands. But I mean, when I think about, and that was it, I was a functioning addict and alcoholic.
I know we're laughing and some people probably think, why are you laughing? It's not funny, but it's such a relief to laugh at certain things because before you come in recovery, it's so dark.
Yeah.
And you really are trying to manage life, manage your thinking, or maybe just blocking everything out.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted to do with this podcast, is to for someone to hear it, whether it's a housewife, a young kid who's starting to go out, someone who's just stuck in addiction or alcoholism, that actually it's a scary proposition to put down something, whether it's a drink or a drug, that's been your support system.
Yeah.
That's looked after you, that's give you confidence in the beginning.
Yeah.
Enabled you to communicate and have conviviality with people. But actually what it's done, it's a turned around and it's taken all that away from you.
Yeah.
So you have no choice.
Yeah.
You know, and I love it when someone says to me, oh, I'm okay, I can control my drinking. And realising that when you control something, it's out of control.
Yeah. And it's just fixing something that it's like, I think with addiction and alcoholism and all of this stuff, it's such like going to the root cause of it. And when we put a substance on the top of it, it's just like the plaster, isn't it? You know, and that thing, what you just said, Paul, about having a choice, you know, when I became aware of how I was harming myself, and people talk about, you know, these moments of clarity, and mine was kind of a slow build up to when I actually thought, oh my God, I'm really in trouble. That awareness. And I had a couple of really mad experiences, again, really scary, where I kind of, it stopped working for me, but I couldn't stop taking it. I was constantly chasing that just numbing out. I didn't want to feel what I was feeling, but I didn't know how I wanted to feel or be. But on the outside, you're all like, everything's great. I was always, everything's great. And when I think back to that, Joe, that makes me really sad, you know, that I just didn't have a clue who I was. And spirituality, I travelled a lot. I did a lot of stuff. So on the outside, it looked great. My job, my work, I had my home. On the outside, it all looked great. I sat on spiritual mountains in India and Thailand and believed I'd found God. Like not a religious one maybe, but spirituality. And I was just lost.
Why were you on the mountain? Was it because you were trying to find something?
Just travelling to these wonderful places off my nut, thinking that I'd found it, but constantly it was always, you know, whether it was a mountain or in like a really sacred spiritual place, you know, and reading all the books. And it was really funny. I was on the way up here, I was thinking, I went away travelling and worked on the cruise ships as well in the height of I was in my mid-20s. And it's very, the crew area is very alcohol-fueled. So it was like a haven for me. And I met a girl there and she bought me a book. She went offshore when we were in America, docking in America, and she bought me The Celestine Prophecy.
I think I read that years ago.
Like 20, you know, people, like we say, like people plant a seed with you. And she bought me this book and I remember opening it and she wrote me, I've still got it. And she wrote me this beautiful little message in the front of it saying, I really pray for you. Please read this. Like, you're really an amazing girl, but I watch you. I don't know if she exactly wrote that, but it was words to that effect. And that's how I feel that this works now, recovery.
I didn't ask you your sobriety dates and how long you've been sober.
I will be celebrating this year 24 years.
Oh, my God. You got sober at 12?
Flattery will get you everywhere. I did get sober at 12.
How has that been? Because
I know.
So your kids have never seen you drinking?
My children have never seen me drunk.
That's amazing.
And that is one of my greatest my greatest things, gifts of recovery, that they've never seen me drunk. And, you know, my first 10 years, recovery is such a journey. You know, when I came into recovery, I was suggested certain things, and some of them I completely ignored and others I took on board. You know, for me, recovery, the fellowships, is really about finding an awareness of yourself and trusting in yourself as well, and not actually listening to everything everyone says.
Just on that note, because some people will be listening to this who have no idea what recovery means.
Okay.
What are you recovering from? It's like if you break a leg, you go to the hospital, you get it fixed, and then you recover through doing rehabilitation and physiotherapy to hopefully get your leg back as it was prior or better. And we're used to saying the word recovery. What does that mean? What are we recovering from?
Recovery for me means acknowledgement of something that wasn't serving me, that was causing me a lot of pain, and having the awareness to do things differently. And you said before about the choice. I felt that when I was using and drinking, I didn't have a choice. But as I have healed myself, if you like, I have choices now. I make really good choices.
Which is amazing, and it's so empowering, because there's a word they use as well in recovery called powerless, which I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm not powerless over anything. What does that mean? And a friend of mine said a really good analogy. He said, so when you go on a date, right, how do you feel before you go on there? I'm like, well, I'm really usually nervous, and I'm worried about what I'm going to say. What is she going to like me? And he said, so that thought process is controlling your emotions and it's making you feel fearful. I'm like, yeah. So that is, you're powerless to the girl. Yeah. You're powerless over the girl's behavior. So if you went in there and didn't worry about what she said, you wouldn't feel insecure and stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess so. So, and then he related that to not being able to say no to a drink once you start, or saying I'm not going to go out tonight, but end up going out. And that was his description of powerless over a drink.
It's brilliant.
Which was fair enough.
And it's so true. And some of the things that you hear, when you're recovering from anything, I suppose it's like when you say, if you've got a broken leg or a hip replacement, you never feel you're going to walk properly again, do you? And I think, I mean, when I came in to recovery, I kind of came into recovery wanting to drink like a lady. I thought, you know, I'm actually not that bad. Or I don't even know, but I thought I want to go out and just be able to have a little glass of wine and be okay. And that wasn't the case, you know, because I never had just one glass of wine. And that healing process of learning, you know, you said about the powerlessness. When I first heard that, I thought, I am not powerless. Because when we used to go out, we used to have this sort of mantra, like, we're powerful as you like. I mean, when I think about that now, like, it makes my heart hurt a little bit, you know. And when I look back at I was completely powerless. And that is so important for me to know, that when I look back, that wasn't powerful. The things I do, the integrity that I have in my life, the choices that I make today are powerful.
Yeah.
And they're based on what is right for me. And I think that people have to remember that when they're recovering from anything, that it's kind of your journey. I think that's really important as well. And what works for you might not be the same for someone else. And I think for me, recovery is really not drinking and taking drugs, getting to know, like, this Joe has really allowed me to be true and authentic to myself.
Yeah, which is amazing, because I think a lot of us as human beings in general don't know who we are. We think we know who we are, and we have habits and things we do, but actually do really sit with yourself and understand who you are. What was the pivotal moment? And did you come in via a treatment centre, or did you go to a 12-step program?
I had a really horrific night out, ended up back at my house with loads of people. They ended up going, felt like they was only there 5 minutes. I was actually probably there for like 5 days. And I was left on my own. And I had a really mad, this is what was happening to me a lot in the end. I was having really bad panic attacks. And I had a really bad panic attack. And I felt like I was a spiritual person, but not in a religious way. And it was really scary. I can actually feel it in my body when I talk about it, you know, and it was a long time ago. And I begged God, help. And a long story short, my friend phoned me and said that a friend of ours had started up a meeting, an AA meeting. It was bank holiday weekend. Do we want to go and support them? My friend didn't know that I was on my knees, like about to literally wanting to end my life. And my first reaction was, what on earth are you asking me to go for? You know, that denial and that, I don't know, so self-righteous, whatever. And anyway, I went to this meeting and I'll never forget it, because there were people there that I knew from being out. And they were sitting there saying they hadn't drunk for 2 years. And I remember sitting there thinking, they're lying. I know them. You know, that don't dare look at myself. Let's just point the finger at everyone else. And I kept going back for a month, every Monday. And I felt safe there. And I didn't drink. I didn't touch anything.
From the first meeting?
From that first meeting. And then after a month, I thought, perhaps I can drink like a lady. And another long story short, I went out to a club and ended up in a grimy toilet putting other substances up my nose. And that was my moment of clarity. And I literally felt like I wanted to rip my skin off. And I just thought, my God, you've got to sort yourself out. And I went back to the meetings and that was my last drink.
It's amazing. It's so powerful because it's when you talked earlier about keeping up appearances, if you like. I remember one of my darkest times was I had two cars I wanted. I had all the watches I wanted. I had a wardrobe I wanted. Had a fabulous career. And I was just destitute inside and couldn't understand why. How's this possible? Mm. And when you are successful, you can't say to people, yeah, my life's rubbish, because they're like, actually, no, it looks pretty amazing on the outside. Mm. And there's always that disconnect between trying to keep up this image, whether it's for ourselves, because I know it was for me to try and say, no, I'm strong, I'm good, I've got this, I'm okay.
It's all good.
Yeah. And probably for others, when really inside, the first thing I read that attracted me to recovery, I was in treatment center and they gave us different books. Mm. And I thought, why am I going to read something? And I just flicked to a page. And on that page, the sentence said, we can look the world in the eye, right? And one of the guys I was in there with said to me, listen, you can wipe this slate clean, no matter what you've done, what you think you've done, because a day prior to that, I was going to take my own life. I decided that I'd had enough. And it's sad to say, but I really did. And I had this weird moment where the phone rang and no one was supposed to phone the room in this treatment center. And it was a friend of mine. He's like, hey, how are you doing? And it just clicked me out of this thought process. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I'm okay. And then when I put the phone down, I thought about my mum. I thought about my nephews who I cared about me. I thought, I can't do this.
Yeah.
And I'm in this body anyway. It was a weird moment. It probably happened very quickly. I'm in this body in the moment. And that guy said, I can start again. And this just said, you can look the world in the eye. And I thought, when did I look anyone in the eye? Mm. Why have I stopped looking people in
the
eye?
Really profound, these moments.
Couldn't even tell you what colour eyes my mum had, and she was my best friend. And that just hit me, and I thought, do you know what? I'm going to do this. Whatever this is, I'm going to have a go at being sober, being in sobriety, not taking anything, because that's not the kid I felt I was born anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I was a happy child, I felt free, but it just got very dark for me.
Yeah.
And I weaned myself on, like I said, for drinking drugs and stuff until it just, by the time I went into treatment, you know, I'd been taken off of 5 airplanes. I'd been in hospital plenty of times.
Mm.
They said I had probably 2 months to live there.
Mm.
And even when I went in that day, I was still like, oh, it's not too bad, you know. Absolutely. So the word denial, someone told me an acronym of don't even know I'm lying,
yeah.
basically to myself, which I thought blew me away yeah. because it's true. You might actually not know that you're lying to yourself because you think
it's
you can do it.
It's that definite feeling of that moment of clarity of, like what Howard just shared as well, I can't do this anymore. Mm. And for me as well, and in my work with everything I do now, the greatest thing someone can do is ask for help. Because once you actually utter those words, you're in a process of healing. And I don't think people realise how powerful that is for someone to say, I can't do this, I need your help. And that's what's so amazing for me about the fellowships of in recovery. And it's not about liking everyone in there because you'll find your people, but it's about that surrender of I can't do this on my own.
And the paradox is that when you do surrender, which I thought was becoming from a boxing background, throw the towel in, I'm done.
No.
It's not. It's the opposite. It's I'm going to surrender to the process I was doing, which was just taking drugs and trying to, you know, kill the pain or whatever it was, to immediate empowerment that you have your control. But like you said, you have good choices. You can, you know, be a good mum, be a good dad, be a good employee, employer. It just completely changes. It takes a bit of time, but it completely changes. So I just wanted to ask you, if there's somebody out there listening to this podcast that knows they're either an addict or alcoholic, or don't know but they're in a really dark place, what would you suggest, where to go and how to ask for help?
There's so many. First of all, getting the identification. So things like this, people listen and they're like, oh my God, yeah, that resonates with me. I can understand how that person's feeling. Because just quickly, I remember when I used to sit in meetings in the early days and hear older people, like we're the old timers now, aren't we?
Thank you very much.
But I used to hear older people, and when I first used to walk in, I used to feel like, what have I got in common with you? It's not about, like I said in the beginning, the outside, the inside, the feelings. I would listen to George, who was 80, sharing about how he felt. And I used to think, oh my God, like I feel like that. So the identification first, having the awareness, and like is said, that gift of desperation, of literally reaching out to one of the fellowships. There's helplines. There's so much. You know, the internet is a curse and a blessing. Mm. But for things like this, it is so accessible to call in help and support. And to just trust that little voice, what we spoke about, that help inside, because we can hear it when we need that help, and to reach out, to go to a meeting or asking for help, for me is the biggest, it's like a jolt forward. It really, really is. And that I remember that sense of relief when I actually finally admitted that I need help. I can't do this on my own. My life is rubbish, you know, and now, I mean, my first years in recovery, trust me, they weren't like, for me, it wasn't just a springboard into like, oh my God, this fantastic life, you know. But sober life for me is such a gift.
Yeah, that's a great point. I just wanted to talk about Stride Foundation.
Yeah.
You are starting our school program.
Yeah.
Going into schools, educating kids, talking to them about drinking drugs, possibilities. Because when I was at school, we had a policeman come in with a suitcase and would open the suitcase and pull out a box and say, if you take this, you will die. If you take this, you're going to end up in a psychiatric unit. If you take this, you'll lose your house. And if you take this, you'll die. And that was it. And the reality is, for me, I went out and smoked puff and whatever, and thought, well, I haven't died, I haven't gone insane, so this is okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what we want to do is provide school talks to schools and places that do have the money or don't have the money, because we're just going to provide it freely anyway. And if they want, they can put a donation back in. If not, it doesn't matter. But really to tell personal stories to kids and students, to give them like, you know, I've been down this path. You don't have to go down there. But if you are on your way, or you suspect you're on your way, or if someone around you is, that you know how to handle the situation, handle peer pressure. And as a coach and someone who's really long in sobriety, I think you, there couldn't be a better person to do it.
I'm so excited to do it because, as I said, I've got young adult children, an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. And it's again, like with adults, the young adults, kids, it's that identification. You know, they want someone that they can feel they relate to. And it's like, it's much more wholesome when we give something to someone that we've experienced ourselves. It's like we can't tell someone about something that we don't know anything about or that we haven't experienced ourselves. The kids have got this filter of, you know,
They have got a radar.
Like my children crucify me. They're like, I can't, you know, you have to be real with them.
And I think there's a big difference between lecturing people, talking at people, or coming from a real experience. You know, I've got friends who are in the army, and if they want to help someone, they need to have or be helped. You need to have a soldier that's been there, because you can identify in a way that no one else ever has.
For sure.
And especially when you've been through something and then come out the other side, you know all the tools. You can see someone who's lying or not sure about it, or seems to be unwell with it as well.
And it's that honesty. Like kids, they love honesty. And also I think another thing is that I'm not a teacher. So there's a different, I'm coming from a different, you know, I'm not a threat. It's just a different level that you're going in. And the kids really respond well to that sort of, I'm not coming in here telling you a story that I've just made up. This is my life.
Hmm.
This is the truth. This is how it was for me. And I want to share that with you. And kids love that as well, you know. Really excited, Paul.
Because also a big thing for me, which I never understood, was peer pressure. And especially being from the UK and other countries as well. You're weird if you don't join in for a drink or a cigarette in the bike sheds, depending on your school, obviously. But there's a real, you know, the word FOMO, there's a real fear of missing out.
It's chronic.
So a lot of people sabotage their health or their common sense or anything, or warnings of the family to belong. And really we want to try and help people understand that you don't have to be like that. You can be a vanguard yourself by saying, hey, you know, I used to say, actually at one point when I was boxing, I used to say, they used to call me the milk kid because I'd drink milk in the pub. But really, like what you said earlier, there was an intuition inside of me that knew that this was probably going to be a bad journey. Yep. And I had moments of savior, like my obsession with boxing and health. I'd drink milk or water in the pub, and I loved it because I was driving at that point as well. Mm-hmm. So I just drive people around, and I really liked being in control. But for me, no one cared at that point.
Yep.
So there's ways of saying stuff when you don't want to join in, but still belong and have a laugh.
It's really about, as well, with the kids, empowering them and exactly what you've just said, letting them know that by saying no to certain things is a real yes to yourself. There's a lot of the youngsters find it hard to find their place. So maybe they go down, you know, the wrong road or whatever. It's about empowerment and having a sense of self and knowing that all the other emotions that teenagers, minefield, that they experience, that they're all quite normal.
Yeah.
And to be able to as well have the resources where they can talk to people as well. I'm so excited about it.
Yeah, no, I'm really excited as well. It's going to be a good new beginning.
Yeah, really looking forward to it.
Joe, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for asking me. I've loved it.
This podcast is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also make a donation. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. And if you enjoyed This Is Powerful, please rate, review, and follow the podcast to share it with your friends, your family, anyone you can, and head over to social media. I always love to see and hear how you react to the episodes, and it's so helpful for our content to be shared. A big thank you to my guest, Jo, and if you want to find out more about her, please check the show notes. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica and Marty, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Henry, you know who you are, and to Emma Long, who does all the hard work in the background. And there's a whole catalogue of episodes wherever you get your podcasts. But did you know you can also watch it on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with Paul Scholfer.